Death of Blessed Terence Albert O'Brien, Bishop and Martyr. Excerpt from Chapter 8 of The Rise and Fall of the Irish Franciscan Monasteries and Memoirs of the Irish Hierarchy in the 17th Century by C.P. Meehan, C.C. When Rinuccini, the papal nuncio, arrived in Ireland, he found several sees vacant, and his first and chiefest care was to have them filled. The candidates were proposed to him by the Supreme Council of the Confederates, and he recommended them for appointment by Innocent X, selecting those who were remarkable for their attachment to his own policy and their devotion to the Apostolic See. Toward the close of 1645, Rinuccini was informed that James O'Hurley, Bishop of Emly, had fallen into bad health, so much so that it was absolutely necessary to provide him with a coadjutor. This infirm and aged prelate, a member of the Order of St. Dominic, had made his religious profession under the shadow of the ancient and once splendid monastery of Kilmallock, and after completing his studies in Spain, was raised to the See of Emly in 1641. His tenure of the episcopate was comparatively brief, and all that we have been able to learn concerning his character is that, like the generality of his order, he was distinguished for learning and zeal. His illness, it would appear, was protracted, for it is quite certain that he did not die until some time in August 1646, that is to say, 12 months after the nuncio's arrival in Ireland. The wish of the dying prelate was that his place might be filled by another Dominican, and the nuncio, being of the same mind, wrote to Rome, recommending Terence Albert O'Brien, provincial of the order in Ireland, as a person eminently qualified for the coadjutorship, and to succeed O'Hurley whenever the death of the latter might occur. Terence Albert O'Brien was born in the year 1600 in the city of Limerick, of parents who were said to trace their descent from the princes of Thomond. But be that as it may, he was destined to reflect fresh luster on the historic name he bore, and to maintain its honor and integrity at a period when others of the same ancient race were degrading it by recreancy to religion and country. While yet a child, he received the earliest rudiments of education from his pious mother and an aged priest who found constant welcome and protection in his father's mansion, and who, in all likelihood, was the first to inspire him with the notion of devoting himself to the ministry. As he grew to boyhood, the desire struck deeper root in his heart, and he lost no time in placing himself in communication with his uncle, Maurice O'Brien, who was then prior of the Dominican convent of his native city. The uncle was not slow in seconding the lad's wishes, and he accordingly had him received into the poor novitiate of the friar's preachers. For we need hardly say that the monastery of St. Saviour, founded in the 13th century by Donat O'Brien, had long since shared the fate of other religious houses in Ireland. Father Maurice was a tender tutor to the young aspirant during the probationary term, and at its close he had the satisfaction of seeing him duly admitted, one of the lambs of that blessed flock which Dominic so leads in righteous ways, as Dante says. In other words, a professed member of the Order of Preachers. The prior's next care was to provide for his nephew's philosophical and theological education, and, in order to perfect him in these branches, he sent him to the convent of St. Peter Martyr at Toledo, where there was then a vacancy for an Irish student. Young O'Brien, accordingly set out for the far-famed city of unrivaled swords, the seat of the Spanish metropolitan, and arrived just as he had entered his 20th year. The Dominican school of Toledo was then one of the most renowned in Spain, and the professors who filled its various chairs were far famed for their erudition in every department of knowledge. Under such able masters, it was only natural to expect that one gifted with the genius and earnestness of purpose which had fallen to young O'Brien's lot should make rapid progress, not only in the Aristotelian philosophy which St. Thomas of Aquinas had reduced to regular system, but also in the sum of theology, which for many centuries had been recognized as the grand code of Latin Christianity, embodying all the moral and dogmatic doctrines of the Church. It is to be regretted that we have only few and spare allusions to O'Brien's collegiate career, but such as have come under our notice warrant us in believing that he distinguished himself as a student, and proved to his Castilian teachers that he possessed an intellect to which the fine distinctions and subtle definitions of the angelic doctor were nowise impalpable. At length, after having passed 8 years in the cloisters of St. Peter's, he was ordained priest, and as the exigencies of the Irish mission were then pressing, his superiors commanded him to lose no time in preparing for the homeward journey. Sad must have been the leave-taking when he bade adieu to the good fathers of St. Peter's, and looked his last on the Alcázar and towers of Toledo's rich cathedral. Sad, no doubt, must have been his farewells as he turned from the banks of the Tagus toward those of the Shannon. But what would they have been had some angel's hand lifted the veil that mercifully hid the future from his eyes? On arriving in Ireland, the scene of his first mission was Limerick, where he abode with the Dominican fathers in a house which they rented in the city, and where they lived in community, as well as the circumstances of the time allowed. It was a period of peril for all priests, but to those of the religious orders especially. For Falkland, the Lord Deputy, was then enforcing the penal enactments, and racking and otherwise torturing various priests supposed to be emissaries from the son of the late Earl of Tyrone, who, if rumor could be believed, was preparing to invade Ireland from Flanders. That the apprehension of the government in regard to this business was purely affected is quite certain. But Lord Falkland made it a pretext for setting a strict watch on such of the clergy as he imagined were corresponding with their brethren in Spain or elsewhere beyond seas. We can therefore conceive with what circumspection the priests, secular and regular, had to act in order to be able to discharge their duty to the people and avoid the suborned delators who were ever on the alert for the wage of their infamy. Strange, however, as it may appear, the government at that period did not entertain so virulent a hatred for the Irish Dominicans as it did for the Franciscans, and consequently the former were allowed to enjoy a comparative freedom of action. This indeed may seem anomalous, but it will cease to be so if we remember that the Franciscans were the most numerous of all the religious orders then in Ireland, and the most notorious for their adhesion to Tyrone and O'Donnell during the late war. We may also observe that the Irish chieftains employed the Franciscans as their agents at foreign courts, patronized them as their analysts, and selected their churches in Valladolid, as well as in Rome, for their place of sepulture. The Dominicans, on the other hand, took no demonstrative part in the transactions to which we have alluded, and this single circumstance accounts for the toleration extended to them by Falkland and some of his predecessors. Availing himself, therefore, of the opportunities which were thus afforded him for doing good, Father O'Brien settled down in the little convent at Limerick, where with the rest of his brethren he toiled through many dreary years in the quiet performance of the duties which belonged to his calling. Affable and unaffected, he was universally esteemed for every good attribute, but above all for that true modesty which has ever been the distinctive mark of steady heads and great souls. Carefully eschewing notoriety, that despicable ambition of vulgar minds, he spent his time as became a true son of St. Dominic, laboring for the preservation of the faith, inculcating its morality, dispensing its blessings, and proving, however unconsciously, that he was a living commentary on the holy rule he professed. Most marked, indeed, was the contrast between the humble chapel of the Limerick convent and those splendid temples of Toledo where he had passed his youth. But if the poverty and simplicity of the former ever caused him a regret, he assuredly had wherewith to console him when he reflected that the highest efforts of human genius could produce no ornament so worthy of God's house as that true piety and faith of which he was a daily witness, and which his precept and example kept alive and active in willing hearts. The deplorable absence of all documents, manuscript as well as printed, relating to the Dominican community at Limerick during the 16 years Father O'Brien spent there, must account for our silence anent that long interval, which we may easily conjecture could not have passed without incidents and episodes of thrilling interest. Fortunately, however, there is evidence to prove that his ability, zeal, and prudence were duly valued by his superiors at home and abroad, so much so that he was twice elected prior of his native convent, after having already held the same office in the convent of Laura. But a far more responsible dignity was reserved for him in 1643, when the Dominican chapter, assembled in the Church of the Trinity at Kilkenny, unanimously elected him their provincial. A short time previously, he had seen his native city identify itself with the Confederates, and we may readily imagine with what feelings of gratitude he and the other members of his order must have regarded the men who restored to them that splendid temple which William Marshall, Earl of Pembroke, in 1225, erected for the honor of God and as a last resting place for his mortality. Toward the close of 1643, Father O'Brien was called to Rome to assist at a general chapter of the Dominicans, which was held in the following year, when many ordinances were decreed for the better government of the Irish province, and the revival of the order in Ireland, where it had suffered so terribly during the persecutions of Elizabeth and James I. The acts of this chapter indeed throw some light on the state of the Irish Church at this period, and it is only reasonable to suppose that we are indebted to O'Brien for the valuable information they contain. As provincial, he must have been consulted by the general on all matters affecting the order in Ireland, and doubtless it was he who, when a question was raised about precedency between the Irish priors, decided the point by a quotation from an ancient manuscript preserved in the works of Sir James Ware. In fact, there can be little doubt that the council was mainly guided by Father O'Brien's judgment in all its decisions regarding Dominican Ireland, for assuredly there was no Irishman then present better qualified to deal with subjects of such importance. We may also remark that his inspirations are clearly perceptible in the projected revival of Dominican schools in Dublin, Limerick, Cashel, Athenry, and Coleraine, and also in those decrees which have special reference to the Irish Dominican institutions for men and women in Lisbon. It was he, doubtless, who moved that the votive offerings made to the far-famed miraculous image of the Blessed Virgin at Yall should be applied to the use of the Dominican convent of that town. And we may further state that it was he who recommended that the convent of St. Peter's Cell in Limerick should be confirmed to Dame Catherine Duggan and the other ladies who resided with her there. These few facts show that the council entertained profound respect for Father O'Brien's wisdom and experience. And indeed, the general of the order was so thoroughly convinced of his deserts that he would not suffer him to leave Rome without some sensible mark of his appreciation. He therefore sanctioned the decree which raised O'Brien to a mastership in theology, and further enhanced this honor by appointing him judge in Munster, with ample powers to decide all controversies that might arise regarding the ancient limits and boundaries of the Dominican convents in that province. As soon as the council terminated its sessions, O'Brien set out for Lisbon to visit the Dominican houses which had been founded in that city by O'Daly, who was then engaged on his History of the Geraldines, a work, we may observe, which is the best that has yet appeared on the subject of which it treats. Would to heaven that O'Daly had left us a fuller biography of his friend, for indeed the notices he has given of him in the Persecutions are meager and most unsatisfactory. O'Daly, however, could not have foreseen the fate that was reserved for O'Brien, or assuredly he would have taken more pains to acquaint himself with all the particulars of his family and early life. About the middle of July 1644, while O'Brien was still in Lisbon, intelligence from Rome led his friends to believe that it was the intention of Urban VIII to advance him to the coadjutorship of Emily. And indeed, this announcement seemed so reliable that he at once set out for Ireland to take place in the election of his successor in the provincialate. There can be little doubt that Pope Urban did mean to have him consecrated bishop, but His Holiness died in the very month the nomination is said to have been made, so the bulls were not dispatched, and O'Brien's promotion was consequently postponed, and did not take place before the third year of the pontificate of Innocent X. On his return to Ireland, O'Brien fixed his residence in the convent of Limerick, where, as provincial and prior, he exerted himself indefatigably for the interests of his order, which had recently gained a large accession to its members from Rome, Louvain, and other places on the continent. The state of Ireland at the period called for this influx, for it was looked upon as the fitting time for the reconstruction of all those venerable corporations which had been scattered by the sword of persecution during the two preceding reigns. Now, however, a notable change had come over the whole island. The greater part of it was in the power of the Confederates, who led the religious orders to believe that they should be speedily repossessed of their suppressed monasteries, and probably of a good portion of their lands, for which some of the lay improprietors were disposed to compound. The people, it need hardly be told, were delighted at the prospect which unfolded itself to their imaginings, for they flattered themselves that they would soon exchange their inexorable lay tyrants for ecclesiastical landlords, who in all ages were proverbially the best and most indulgent. It was only natural that a man of O'Brien's ardent temperament should have shared the general enthusiasm. Nay, and persuaded himself that the religious communities were on the eve of being redeemed forever from the trammels of those sanguinary laws which had heretofore doomed them to death and expatriation. May we not, therefore, suppose that he counted on seeing his own order re-established, its grand old sanctuaries restored to their rightful owners, and the youth of the land frequenting Dominican schools, as they did in those days when the friars' preachers built the first bridge across the Liffey for the convenience of their scholars. At that moment, indeed, the course of events was calculated to confirm his belief in these forecastings, and if it ever occurred to him that they were nothing more than pleasing illusions, surely all misgivings must have vanished when he heard that a high minister from the Holy See had already landed on the Irish coast, bringing with him arms, specie, and munitions for the encouragement and maintenance of the Confederate Catholics. Although Rinuccini's correspondence does not mention the fact, there is every reason to suppose that Father O'Brien was present at the grand reception given to that personage on his arrival in Limerick. Nor can we doubt that he assisted at another solemnity that took place there, when the nuncio, accompanied by Walsh, Archbishop of Cashel, the clergy, secular and regular, and the entire garrison, walked to St. Mary's to give God thanks for the signal defeat which the Scotch Covenanters had sustained at Benburb. All Limerick was astir on this occasion, and the nuncio himself tells us that even the windows were filled with groups anxious to get a sight of the tattered banners that were wrested from the Covenanters on the victorious field. How could the provincial of the Dominicans and prior of Limerick be absent at a moment of such thrilling solemnity? A few days afterward, there was a display of a similar character in the streets of the ancient city, when the nuncio again went to St. Mary's to chant Te Deum for the fall of Bunratty, where he himself directed the siege operations, and Father Collins, a Dominican, crucifix in hand, led the storming party to the breach, and drove the enemy out of their entrenchments. The acquisition of this place was a matter of great moment to the Confederates, and as its capture was in some measure due to a simple Dominican priest, it is more than likely that his provincial did not absent himself from the solemnity which Rinuccini caused to be observed in honor of such an important event. As the foregoing notices of Father O'Brien are at best only conjectural, we now turn to others that are beyond the reach of all doubt and cavil. We have already said that he was not consecrated in 1644, as De Burgo and O'Daly would have had us believe, and this assertion is fully borne out by the nuncio, who, in a letter dated Kilkenny, January 1, 1646, writes thus: "Father Terence, provincial of the Dominicans, is a man of prudence and sagacity. He has been in Italy, has had considerable experience, and the bishop who wishes to have him for his coadjutor is, I am told, in very feeble health." 8 months after the date of that letter, that is to say, in August 1646, when the Bishop of Emly was on the point of death, the nuncio again wrote to Rome recommending various candidates for dioceses that were then either vacant or about to be so, and, among others, he distinctly names O'Brien as one who deserved the highest advancement Rome could bestow, and whose claims and qualifications were duly set forth in a memorial which the clergy had forwarded in his favor. The answer, however, did not reach Ireland till October 1647, when Rinuccini had the satisfaction of learning that the Holy See sanctioned O'Brien's promotion, and that of the other candidates for whom he was interested. O'Brien's consecration was solemnized in the following November. But we confess our inability to name the church where the ceremony was performed. It is certain, however, that the nuncio acted as consecrating prelate on the occasion, and there is some reason to believe that the function took place in Kilkenny, either in the grand old Dominican church or in the cathedral of St. Canice. Having now attained the dignity to which he was well entitled, O'Brien lost no time in taking possession of his see and making provision for the flock committed to his charge. but the condition of his people at that period was truly deplorable, and the wild raids of the renegade Inchiquin afforded him little opportunity for attending his diocese as he would fain have done. The victory of Knocknanos, fought 13th November 1647, made Inchiquin absolute master of nearly all Munster for a while, and no part of it suffered so fearfully as the district lying west of Cashel. Brief space, therefore, had the bishop for repairing and reconciling the dismantled and desecrated churches. And as Inchiquin hated the nuncio, we may readily conceive with what feelings he must have regarded a prelate who, though of his own name and race, was devotedly and zealously attached to the policy of the Italian. Nevertheless, O'Brien did all he could for his poor flock, exhorting them to patience and endurance under their hard trials, and laboring as well as the circumstances of the times allowed to keep the faith alive and active in their hearts. It is needless to observe that in performing these duties he exposed himself to great risk, and had to be constantly on his guard against Inchiquin's followers, many of whom, like their chief, were traitors to creed and country. Withal, he did his work earnestly and efficiently, breaking the bread of life to the young and old on the hillsides and in the glens, till the Ulster Irish under Owen O'Neill came down on the plains of Munster, drove Inchiquin before him, and placed the Catholics once more in possession of their churches. Triumphs such as these, however, were short-lived, and the reverses that followed in quick succession compelled the pastor to leave his flock in charge of a vicar while he himself was absent at Kilkenny, advocating the nuncio's policy, condemning the truce with Inchiquin, and approving that fatal recourse to excommunication and interdict against all abettors of that unsatisfactory measure. Anticipating the consequences of this proceeding, the nuncio fled to Galway to watch the course of events and make preparations for his departure from the scene of his ill-starred mission. Meanwhile, Lord Ormond returned to Ireland, resumed the government, and intimated that the nuncio must leave the kingdom with all possible speed. As for Ormond, some of the bishops, French of Ferns, O'Dwyer of Limerick, and John, Archbishop of Tuam, hailed his arrival as the harbinger of a new era, and employed all their logic to convince their colleagues that the salvation of Ireland could not be effected till it accepted Ormond's dictatorship, or, in other words, submitted itself to his guidance. It was deemed expedient, therefore, to get up a congratulatory address embodying this sentiment, and the prelates we have named wrote to Walsh, Archbishop of Cashel, Comerford of Waterford, and O'Brien of Emly, inviting them to Kilkenny to take part in the proceedings, which, as was alleged, had already been approved at Rome. O'Brien obeyed the summons, but on finding that the projected address was not authorized by the Holy See, he made his escape from Kilkenny and set out for Galway to give the unfortunate nuncio the last proof of his unaltered allegiance. He was not destined, however, to have that melancholy satisfaction, for on arriving at a village within 3 miles of Galway, word was brought him that the San Pietro had come round from Waterford and sailed with the nuncio and his suite for the coast of France. What could O'Brien do but wish his friend and patron a fair wind to waft him on his way, and keep him clear of the parliamentary ships that were then cruising in the Irish waters under the command of the notorious Plunkett? Notwithstanding all the difficulties that beset him for his devotedness to Rinuccini's policy, O'Brien returned to his diocese soon after the former had taken his departure, and remained there toiling for his flock till May 1650, when the progress of the Cromwellians compelled him to return to Galway. At that period, Munster was a scene of desolation and carnage, and among those who sealed their loyalty with their blood was Boetius Egan, Bishop of Ross, heretofore Definitor General of the Franciscans. His tenure in the episcopate was brief indeed, for when the Cromwellians had overrun Carbery, he was obliged to take himself to the fastnesses of Kerry, where David Roche had cantoned some 600 or 700 Confederate soldiers. Along with this force, the bishop marched into the county Cork, and on the 1st of May 1650, just as the vanguard had reached Macroom, Lord Broghill attacked and routed it, and made the bishop prisoner. Broghill, we need hardly say, was a merciless scoundrel, for although he had pledged his word that no harm should be done the captive prelate, he nevertheless caused him to be hanged with the reins of his horse on a hill overlooking Carrigadroit, and there left his remains till they were removed at dead of night by some commiserating peasants, who buried them in the ancient cemetery of Aghina. In August of the same year, 1650, O'Brien acted with those prelates who, after repudiating Lord Ormond and insisting on the appointment of Clanricarde as viceroy, sent a deputation to the Duke of Lorraine offering him the protectorate of Ireland, on certain conditions, which, as we have seen in a former paper, were never realized. O'Brien then returned to his diocese, and after a brief sojourn there, made his way to Limerick just as Ireton was marching on that doomed city. As the history of that siege is too well known to need repetition here, our notices must be limited to such passages as have special reference to the Bishop of Emly, whose conduct during that 6 months' memorable struggle was honorable and heroic to the last. In the midst of the pestilence which carried off 5,000 citizens, he proved himself a man of zeal and charity, and in the council chamber, where a clique of traitors from time to time insisted on the necessity of capitulating, he protested energetically against all accommodation with Ireton. It has been said that Ireton offered him a large sum of money with freedom to go where he liked, provided he induced the garrison to lay down their arms and surrender. But although such assertion may be gratuitous, there are instances enough to show that O'Brien was as true as he was uncompromising. O'Dwyer, Bishop of Limerick, and Walsh, Archbishop of Cashel, were within the walls during the siege, but neither of them acted the brave and manly part which earned for O'Brien the inexorable hostility of Ireton. The two former dignitaries, indeed, labored unsparingly in the pest-house for the spiritual comfort of the plague-stricken, and in the hospitals which were crowded by soldiers mortally wounded. But O'Brien, instead of confining himself to hospital or pest-house, made the ramparts the scene of his charity, and there, like Cardinal Ximenes and other warrior prelates, with whose history his Spanish studies made him acquainted, he acted the double role of priest and soldier, encouraging the faint-hearted and absolving the dying as the plague slew them at his feet. It must also be recorded to his honor that he sternly opposed Ireton's proposals from first to last, and did his utmost to convince the Council of War that the city had abundant resources to sustain a more protracted siege, and finally that approaching winter, dearth, and infection must compel the Parliamentarian General to break up his camp and retire from before the walls. The divisions, however, that grew rife in the town, and above all the treason of Fennel, whose life Major General O'Neill so unwisely spared at Clonmel, marred all his patriotic efforts, and gave Limerick to Ireton. The latter, as might be expected, could not but regard O'Brien as his mortal and persistent enemy, and notwithstanding all negotiations which were attempted in his behalf, nothing could induce the Parliamentarian General to include him in the list of those who were received to pardon, knowing the fate that was reserved to him when the city surrendered. O'Brien retired to the pest-house. not indeed for the purpose of secreting himself, as has been commonly thought, but rather that he might devote the last moments of his life to the benefit of his suffering fellow citizens, and prepare himself for death. The officers who were charged with his arrest found him thus employed, and they instantly conducted him to the headquarters of Ireton, who told him that he was to be tried by a court-martial and imprisoned till sentence was found. O'Brien heard this without moving a muscle, and when Ireton demanded, "Did he want counsel?" he calmly replied that all he required was his confessor. This boon was granted, and Father Hanrahan, a member of his own order, was suffered to pass the whole day and night of the 30th October with him in his prison cell. On the following evening, the finding of the court was announced to him, as he lay stripped on a pallet. And the officer charged with this lugubrious duty gave him to understand that the sentence was to be carried out on the instant. On hearing this, he got up to dress himself, but before he had time to do so, the provost marshal's guard pinioned his arms and thrust him out of the cell, almost in a state of nudity. It was only natural that his fine sense of delicacy should resent this cruel insult, but finding that all remonstrances were lost on the ruffians who surrounded him, he paused an instant as if to collect himself, and said in a solemn tone that the time was not distant when Ireton should stand before God's tribunal to account for his bloody deeds. Surely they must have jeered him as a prophet of evil. It was a long way from the prison to the place of execution, and as the escort proceeded, it was encountered at every step by sights more appalling than that of a man going to the gallows. For 2 days previously, Ireton's troops had been allowed to pillage and slay as they chose, and there was hardly a house that did not bear witness to their fierce licentiousness. Windows shattered, doors wrenched from their hinges, corpses of men and women lying stark in the kennels, wares of every sort scattered and trodden underfoot, showed that destructiveness had reveled to satiety. No living thing appeared along the route of that sad procession, and the universal stillness would have been unbroken were it not for the heavy tread of the doomed man's guard and the ringing of their weapons as they clashed against the pavement. O'Brien, however, conducted himself with his accustomed firmness, and though distressed at being obliged to parade the deserted thoroughfares on that winter's evening, in a state little short of absolute nakedness, his step was as steady and his bearing erect as either could have been on that memorable day when he followed the trophies of Benburb to St. Mary's Cathedral. On reaching the foot of the gibbet, he knelt and prayed till he was commanded to arise and mount the ladder. He obeyed, seized the rungs with vigorous grasp, and turned round, as if anxious to ascertain whether any of the citizens had ventured abroad to witness his death scene. Having satisfied himself that a few of them were present and within hearing, he exhorted them to continue true to the faith of their fathers, and hope for better days, when God would look with mercy on unhappy Ireland. A few moments more, and his soul was with the just. Thus did Terence Albert O'Brien pass out of this life on All Saints' Eve, 1651. As soon as life was extinct, the executioner lowered the body to the ground, and after the soldiers had discharged their muskets at it, he hacked off the head and impaled it on the tower of St. John's Gate, where it remained many a day, a ghastly evidence of Ireton's vindictiveness. O'Brien's execution was speedily followed by that of several priests of the Dominican order, among the most distinguished of whom were Fathers Wolfe and Collins. Both were sentenced by court-martial, and both died as became them, with Christian courage and Christian hope. Ireton, indeed, dealt unsparingly with the Dominicans, for he knew that they were the nuncio's most faithful and uncompromising adherents, and that every member of the order, with one solitary exception, advocated his policy not only while he was in Ireland, but when he was far away in his principality of Fermo. Persistently heroic during the siege, they exhibited the same undaunted composure on the scaffold, and their conduct in the latter instance contrasted strongly with that of the temporizing Major General Purcell, who swooned at the sight of the halter, and had to be assisted by two musketeers while mounting the ladder. Among the laymen who suffered at this time, there were two whom we may not pass over in silence. These were Dominic Fanning, and a personage which a contemporary manuscript styles the Baron of Castleconnell, the same, perhaps, who basely abandoned the field of Knocknanos. Fanning, we need hardly say, was in the interest of the nuncio's party throughout, and when the city surrendered, he fled, and secreted himself in the tomb of his ancestors in the Franciscan church. While lying hid there, a picket entered the church, and lit a fire for the purpose of cooking, and when Fanning saw them thus employed, he crept out, and half frozen as he was, sat down to warm himself. The captain of the party kicked him off, and he then endeavored to escape out of the city, but was arrested at the gate, brought back, and being identified, was immediately hanged. His servant, it seems, involved himself soon afterwards with the soldiers, and in a scuffle that ensued, was killed on the spot by the captain who had driven Fanning from the fire. The writer to whom we are indebted for this information gives the following account of the Baron of Castleconnell. Being sentenced to die, he applied to Ireton for respite of execution till his return from his lodging, where he broke open his trunks, and finding there a new suit of white taffety, attired himself in it. He then rode gallantly to the place of execution, and behaved so jocosely that he caused wonder. Being asked about the change of clothes, he replied that, if to marry a creature he would have done no less, why should I not do so now, when I believe I am about to marry heaven? Of O'Dwyer, Bishop of Limerick, and the Archbishop of Cashel, we have only to add that Ludlow pleaded for the former, that he did not belong to the nuncio's extreme party, and that the latter had the same extenuating circumstances in his favor. O'Dwyer was suffered to escape, and the archbishop went quietly away, both, says the author of the aphorismical discovery, being protected, because they were of the party of Ormond and Clan Ricard. It was on the 10th of November, when all this cold-blooded butchery was done, that Ireton was seized with the epidemic which had been ravaging the whole island for nearly an entire year. In the course of a few days, he gradually grew worse and more faint, and at length inflammatory fever supervened. In his delirium, says Sir Philip Warwick, he shouted repeatedly, "Blood! Blood! I must have more blood!" And if we may believe other writers, who had similar opportunities for informing themselves concerning the last moments of this wretched man, the Bishop of Emly was so palpably before him that he had to turn his face to the wall to avoid the ghastly apparition. In the wild outbursts of his frenzy, he over and over again repeated that he was guiltless of the bishop's death, that he had no hand in it, and that the court-martial alone was responsible for the sentence and execution. These, however, were nothing more than echoes of a guilty conscience, unsoftened by a single expression of regret or repentance. unavailing protestations and arguments thrown away on the bloody specter that never left his bedside till God called him to judgment after 16 days of unmitigated suffering. Need we say that O'Brien's prophecy was fulfilled? And may we not suppose that he confronted his murderer at God's tribunal? There can be no doubt that Ireton's conduct to O'Brien was merciless and exceptional, for he pardoned Hugh O'Neill, who was as obstinate as the bishop in refusing to capitulate. Nay, more, had Ireton been disposed to act considerately or impartially, he surely would have discovered that the man by whom he was beaten at Clonmel, and who left him nothing there but a breached and bloody wall, was less entitled to mercy than an ecclesiastical dignitary, who as such was nowise amenable to a military tribunal. The remonstrances of his officers induced him to cancel the sentence pronounced against the Lieutenant General Hugh, Owen Roe's nephew, and O'Dwyer, although accepted from the Articles of Treaty, received protection at his hands. Why he did not extend the same benefit to O'Brien, we cannot say, but it may be fairly presumed that he was actuated by feelings of intense hatred and vindictiveness to that illustrious personage. In conclusion, let us mention a fact not generally known. Ireton not only pardoned O'Neill, but conferred on him unmistakable proofs of his esteem and friendship. For, says the manuscript authority from which these particulars are taken, so tender was Ireton of O'Neill's safety that he charged his lieutenant upon pain of his displeasure to wait on him. And when he was on the point of death, Ireton commanded his said lieutenant to use all good behavior to the Irish general, and send him with his corpse into England. He also bestowed on him 3 horses, one for himself, the other 2 for 2 servants to wait on him, with a lackey, all at his proper expense. And so it was, for Hugh O'Neill accompanied the remains to London, and he was there released. The corpse, we need hardly add, was buried with great pomp in Westminster Abbey. End of The Death of Terence Albert O'Brien. Excerpt from The Rise and Fall of the Irish Franciscan Monasteries and Memoirs of the Irish Hierarchy in the 17th Century.